This week on Life and Faith.
Maybe I've been unintendedly plagiarising the Bible in my work. Or maybe I just listened to enough of it as a kid that it has seeped into some of my thinking.
We have entered into an amusing ourselves to death moment in history.
It doesn't make sense to me. If there is God, God's supposed to be free.
I was 100% sure that I was sacrificing on the altar of truth my only chance for happiness in this world.
Miracles don't necessarily change anybody's mind. It just gets their attention.
And so I had to run with my child on my back, the ISA army coming behind us.
I said, gee, Uncle George, this is luxurious for a communist. Son, he said, nothing's too good for the worker, nothing.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Justine Toe. Happy New Year, everyone.
Yeah, welcome to New Year and more Life and Faith for 2020. We're really excited to get back into it all. And we've got some great episodes lined up. Now, I know it's not quite New Year anymore. It is February. But I know, Justine, you like to make New Year's resolutions. Are you still going with any of the ones you made this year?
I think you can predict what I'm about to say. No, of course not. You know, I have a really familiar formula that I rely upon, which is New Year, New You. And every year I fail to become that new you, but I live in hope that I will become.
A couple of days where you can feel that sense of a new opening.
Yes, that's right. And I then make the resolution to, you know, get to my 10,000 steps daily or to pray more or, you know, reduce my screen time. And I break all of them, basically. What about you? Are you one for
well,
New
you know,
Year's resolutions?
We go on holidays every year with another family. And a year ago, I remembered this year, I made some statement about, in a year's time, I'm going to be able to touch my toes by this time next year. I stood on that balcony again this year. I couldn't get close. I'm really inflexible.
Well, I think it's probably the experience of most people. It is certainly mine that you start off the new year with good intentions and then you inevitably fall away, right? Because reality sets in. Yeah. You're still you.
Yeah, I'm sure plenty of people can identify with that feeling that they need to improve or have a fresh start. And that must be the impulse behind a lot of the stuff we're talking about today, which is the search for wellness.
Yeah, we're talking to Bridget Delaney, and she's the author of Wellmania, Misadventures in the Search for Wellness. Now, she's the senior writer for The Guardian. She's also a journalist, author, lawyer, travel writer, novelist as well. And in this book, she's both a reporter and a guinea pig also for all these wellness adventures. And I've been quite obsessed with her for some time.
Yeah, why are you so obsessed with wellness? And by that, you mean, of course, sort of healthy living, isn't it?
Yeah, so I guess wellness, Bridget uses it as an umbrella term for, you know, clean eating. That was a big craze a couple of years ago. Detox diets, yoga, meditation, mindfulness, all that sort of stuff. But I'm obsessed with wellness because I feel like it's religion for people who don't want religion or don't care about religion or who think it does not apply to them.
As a sort of religious vibe to it.
Yeah, well, it's a replacement of kind. So Bridget starts off her book talking about how, you know, feasting and fasting, which is this kind of cycle of excess or overindulgence and then dieting, which I think a lot of us can identify with. Mm. She says that it used to be imbued with religious practice or it had a religious element to it. But then she says that that religious calendar has been replaced by the party calendar. Mm. And she says, linking this very much to Australia, that you've got the party season kicking off with Melbourne Cup. And then on through Christmas and New Year, through the long hot summer all the way to Australia Day, Australia just kind of like kicks back, lives it up, eats a lot, drinks a lot. But then when February rolls around and you've got to get back to real life, you have to tighten your belt, except you can't anymore because you've overindulged. And so we diet, right? So we go on a detox. Mm,
feels like you're describing at least some part of my life there, Justine. So even if Australia is a very secular country, the party season followed by the New Year diet, something of a, has this sort of maybe even a liturgical rhythm to it in the sense of a kind of following a calendar.
Yeah, it's like a practice. And so it feels like maybe this might be religion in another guise. And we'll get all into this with Bridget. She's got such a great eye for detail. And on that note, be warned, Sydney beachside suburb Bondi, which is the home of insufferably beautiful people, comes in for quite a bit of a ribbing. But I thought the perfect way to begin our chat was to get her to describe to me the perfect Instagram post that summarises wellness.
Well, it would have to be at Bondi Beach, which is the home of wellness, or Byron Bay. And it would be a woman in expensive yoga gear doing a one-armed handstand while a green smoothie is waiting for her in the background of the shot. And she's fit-looking and toned, but not too gaunt. And she's got
a borderline gaunt, let's be honest.
Okay. She has a healthy tan, healthy hair, minimal makeup. It looks easy to achieve. It's actually very hard.
You mentioned Bondi. In your book, Wellmania, you also talk about the Bondi paradox. How does that fit in with the picture of wellness that you've just sketched?
Well, I've lived in Bondi off and on since the early 2000s, and I'm fascinated with it because it's almost become like a brand that's exported around the world. And there's a lot of yoga studios there, and there's a lot of juice bars, and it's now increasingly expensive to live there. And often you'll watch the news and some of the biggest drug busts happen in Bondi, and people are dragged out of their multi-million dollar houses in sort of yoga pants after, you know, having huge shipments of cocaine found in their garage. So it's a paradox because, there's the party aspect of Sydney, which has always been located in and around Bondi. But there's also been this real aesthetic about wellness and about, you know, looking after yourself and looking after your body, whilst at the same time kind of trashing it on weekends.
Yeah, in the book, I love how you put it. You talk about how the yoga is a corrective to the cocaine.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the Bondi paradox. Now, you describe your adventures in wellness, or misadventures, to pick up your book's title, through a series of words: clean, lean, and serene. Can you walk us through what each of those meant to you?
In relation to Wellmania, clean is a detox that I did where I fasted for quite a long period of time in effort to rid myself of toxins and become clean. Lean is a look at yoga and the yoga culture and what that promises and where that's come from. And serene is, you know, kind of the third pillar, which is mindfulness, which when I was writing the book, over a period of many years, I could see the rise of mindfulness and meditation, you know, going into the mainstream. And so that made sense as, you know, a strong sort of aspect to look at.
And when you talk about the clean, the detox diet that you went on, like you mentioned that Malcolm Turnbull's done it. So it's not like this like really fringe thing, right? There's lots of well-fed politicians who are taking up this diet. What did it involve?
So I thought that because Turnbull had done it, there was a stamp of, you know, possibly sobriety or science behind it. But it really was an edgy diet to do. It basically involves not eating anything for 2 weeks and then for 101 days having very little food and going and having acupuncture and taking Chinese medicine most days.
And after that 2 weeks, you're eating something like a bit of cucumber and then the next day a bit of chicken that's three fingers big or something like that. That sounds insane.
So part of the issue with when you go on such a long fast is you can't have too much food straight away because you can get incredibly sick. So so you have to reintroduce food gradually. But it is a form of disordered eating. So for the first day, it's half a cucumber. The second is 50 grams of chicken. And the third is an egg. And you repeat that sort of food program for the next few weeks until you add a bit more food and a bit more food.
It strikes me that the word clean feels really morally charged. And especially when it comes to women, right? Like, would you say that detoxing is just code for like being skinny? You said it was that this particular diet that you did was a form of disordered eating.
It's yes to the skinniness, but also it was something else, which is about the idea that what's in your body and what's in your, you know, bowels or intestines are terrible toxins that need to be removed. So there's a kind of almost puritanical disgust with the inner workings of the body. And you know, you speak to, or I spoke to a number of experts who said that, you know, the body already has all the things in it that we need to detox. It has lungs, it has a liver, it has kidneys. Unless you are on, you know, you have some sort of drug addiction or alcoholism, you know, you don't need to detox. Like it's a kind of made up concept.
Let's talk about lean, where you did this daily yoga practice for a number of weeks. Mm. You talk about how a lot of young women are taking their broken bodies and broken hearts, quote unquote, to yoga. Mm. What's going on there and how did you find that?
I've kind of had a bit of an anthropological sort of point of view with yoga, which was I grew up in a household where both my parents are Catholic. I went to Catholic schools. So I had a lot of theology and a lot of messages and lessons, and you know, I did religion at school. So my life wasn't devoid of that type of content. But a lot of people younger than me who were going to yoga, I got the sense that they hadn't had any instruction in their lives that had a moral or spiritual kind of element. Some of the yoga classes I was attending kind of really stepped into that breach. So a lot of classes at about 75% of the way in will have this thing that I call a nugget of truth, where they'll start talking, the teacher will start talking about, you know, bigger themes like connection or your heart or kind of compassion. And, a lot of people seem to really receive those messages, you know, kind of really hungrily, and that was really interesting to observe.
Can you talk to me about your hunt for serenity? What does that encapsulate for you? What does that mean?
I think serenity is the most important aspect of this book. Bodies will always change shape. You know, people gain weight, they lose weight, they're well, they're unwell. It's in a state of flux. Likewise with yoga, you know, people fall out of habits. But I was looking with serenity for something that could be a lasting thing. So a practice or some sort of, you know, accord with the world where a lot of the ups and downs would even out. So
you mean like a base from which you could live at so that all the stuff happening on top would not hit you really deep?
Yeah, exactly. So and that was in many ways the most interesting search because, you know, all else flows from that. If you have a really good base, you can have a number of rough rides and it'll be okay. So as I said, like meditation was becoming quite big when I started researching the book. And I was interested how difficult a lot of people found it, including myself, you know, how hard it was to be still and to sit in a room and be quiet. And to quieten your mind. Whilst meditation was becoming really mainstream, so were smartphones. So it coincided, I think one of the first times I did a meditation retreat, which was in London in 2007, was probably around the same time that Facebook, that I joined Facebook and Facebook became mainstream. So it's kind of no accident that when we're being more distracted and disrupted than ever before, that we will search for an antidote to that.
Totally. I think we are still finding our way through that maze, and mindfulness, as you say, has really hit the mainstream now. I was really struck by the definition that you offered of serenity in your book. You talk about how the words of a religious friend were really helpful to you. They described it as the peace that the world can't give. Now, I have to admit, when I read that, I was like, well, I've heard this before. And in the Bible, there's the Gospel of John, and Jesus says something about the peace that the world cannot give. It's what he can give people.
Just let me break in here. The quote from Jesus, which Justine didn't have at hand during the interview, is this: "Peace I leave with you, my peace I give you. I do not give to you as the world gives. Do not let your hearts be troubled, and do not be afraid." You can find it if you plug John 14 space 17 into your search engine. Back to the interview.
So can we talk more about that religious backstory that you've got? And were you aware of that resonance in the biblical text, or what's going on there?
So it's been a long time since I've read the Bible. although I'm aware of like the Gospels, I've always been interested in the social justice aspects of the New Testament and of Jesus. And I think that's really instructive. But, you know, there was a lot of, there's a lot of movement in the Bible. There's a lot of, particularly the Old Testament, there's a lot of chaos and there's a lot of, there's a lot of big characters. So it's not necessarily a book or a text where peace jumps out immediately. I think you have to search for it. But amongst a number of religious figures from all religions that I connected with in this book, there was a base like element in common, which was this serenity, and that was accessed through kind of a spiritual path.
My turn to interrupt. At this point, I suggested to Bridget that she unwittingly quoted the Bible elsewhere in Wellmania. Now, I totally flubbed the quote during the interview, but here's what she writes. Serenity is the rock on which all else can be built. If your foundations are built on sand, then all that rests on them is liable to collapse.
This is sounding familiar. If you're aware of the Gospel of Matthew, you'll know that this is channeling a well-known story Jesus told. It's often referred to as the parable about the wise and foolish builders. Well, Jesus says that people who base their life on his words are like those who build houses on rock, whereas those who don't are like houses built on sand, which can't withstand the storms of life. If you'd like to chase up that reference, just type Matthew 7, space 24 into your search engine. Back to the interview.
You should revisit the Bible and reread the Bible after having a look at your book, because there's a lot of interesting things going on there.
Maybe I've been unintendedly plagiarising the Bible in my work. Or maybe I just listened to enough of it as a kid that it has seeped into some of my thinking.
Yeah, well, how about we talk about that? Because it seems that, and you do deal with this in the book, that wellness, you propose, has become some kind of replacement for religion. I mean, you've already mentioned that with the younger women that are kind of lapping up this spiritual instruction that they're receiving from their yoga teachers. So you see it as religion light. I think it's a nice way that you put it.
I do. I guess there's been, particularly in the Catholic Church in recent years, a lot of mistrust, you know, a lot of sort of real people being really appalled about what's been going on. And that's not going to take away the spiritual thirst, but it does mean that there's not necessarily a place where people feel safe to explore that need. So, you know, I think it's a shame that people are going to yoga class to find something. I mean, not everyone who goes to yoga is a spiritual seeker, but there is a lot of it. But where people get that these days, you know, I guess it's a really personal thing. I think yoga, you know, can make you start thinking about things, but it's not really enough to fill that hole.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity, and Justine is talking to Bridget Delaney, a columnist with The Guardian, about her book Wellmania, Misadventures in the Search for Wellness. And they've just been talking about the resonances between religion and wellness culture. Yoga, raw food, clean eating, mindfulness. The ways in which wellness is religion light, that's L-I-T-E, for people who can't stand the church.
Yeah, she named the wariness people feel about organised religion and said, quote unquote, the church had to win back trust and be more inclusive. But now we turn to her work with The Guardian and get into things like the federal election in 2019. And here I cite a few examples of her work, and we'll include these in the show notes to this episode.
You maintain a public diary, for lack of a better word, for The Guardian. And you wrote fairly recently that in the same article where you're talking about the conviction of Pell and the Royal Commission having killed off any lingering faith that you might have had. You also mentioned, though, that that you're conscious of a void left by religion, but that you can't see going back to any sort of organised institution. But you also quote Jesus. You say, whatever you do to the least of my brothers, you do unto me. And you say that this remains one of the most radical statements ever made by a public figure. If only we could live by that, how different the world would be. You still believe that in spite of everything?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a really powerful it's a really powerful line for me. If you apply that line to how we govern, to how we treat people on the street, to how we, you know, connect with, say, or how we kind of resolve our disputes, it's radical in the fact that if you apply it, it can change everything. But it's really hard to do. We're now speaking in your offices, which is just off Martin Place. You know, there, I thought of that line a lot when there were a lot of homeless people encamped there maybe a year or so ago. How do we treat this group of people? What's my relationship as a citizen of Sydney to these people who are really marginalised? And, you know, I thought of that line, like how I treat them, the least of my brothers, is how I would be treated myself. So, you know, it's courtesy, respect, compassion, listening, no judgment. So all the things I wanted for myself, I try and, you know, push out to others. Simple but hard.
Okay, you've mentioned Bondi already, and in your book, I remember reading that the first week that you go to the yoga practice, people have to stand up and say two words that encapsulate why they're there.
Mm.
And there's a lot of tears and sniffles that eventuate over the course of that. And so I'm just imagining it in my head. You're in Bondi, you're in a room full of beautiful, bendy people, but they have these really sad eyes and they're saying things like they want love and acceptance and they want connection.
Mm.
So that must be another feature of a Bondi paradox, I guess. Mm. Like people are really beautiful there, but there's a sadness there.
Mm. I think it's not just Bondi. I think it's everywhere. I mean, I live most of the year in country Victoria. I'm in Sydney at the moment. And there's a completely different way of relating there. So I know my neighbours really well, in part because I have to. Like I rely on them very heavily. Like there was a snake found at my place 2 days ago. It was a massive brown snake and my neighbour found it and she went and she got door stoppers and she hand cut the grass around my place.
That's a good neighbour.
It's a good neighbour, yeah. But it's also, you know, if you try and thank her and say, you're amazing, she's like, well, no, this is what neighbours do. And there's a contrast with when I live in Bondi, don't know who my neighbours are, don't make eye contact in the street. Like there's no exchange, there's no reciprocity between people. And that's, you know, that could be a Sydney thing, that could be a city thing, but it does mean that people float around a bit in Sydney without those connections. And my neighbours and I are really different people. Like we're, you know, I would probably have more in common with my neighbours in Sydney, but I have a much deeper and much stronger relationship with my neighbours in Castlemaine. The sadness that I see in the people that are, you know, for example, in that yoga class, you know, a lot of it has to do with, you know, individualism, and it has to do with people working really hard on themselves and striving really hard to be the best self that they can be and looking after themselves, but not necessarily having compassionate relationships with others. So they look great and yeah, they kind of wonder, well, why don't I feel great? I look really good. I go to yoga every day. I only eat organic food and I've got this great job, but yet there's something missing.
Well, this is a huge theme that comes out in your book. You start to worry that wellness is a quote-unquote project of self that swaps social change for individual transformation.
Mm. Yeah, that's still a concern of mine. There's been a sort of rise in the use of this word self-care, which actually is an African-American activist term, where black women would talk about needing time to care for themselves in the, you know, during the work that they were doing, you know, in changing legislation or taking to the streets or marching. It's now kind of been co-opted by white women who are going to day spas, and self-care is all well and good, but what about collective care? that's something I think we have a bit more trouble with as a society.
And you've gone to a lot of exotic wellness retreats across the globe, and it's out there that you're experiencing this sort of pampering that you're kind of having a laugh at now, but it is connected very much with the wellness industrial complex and that urge to self-care, and it's very expensive self-care at the expense of, you know, the water in Bali, which I know you're very concerned about because that rush to development has meant that it's not, there's not proper care taken with the environment.
There's a couple of places in Bali that are in kind of mortal danger of you know, ecological collapse because the water table can't sustain the amount of tourism and development that's happening. So it's always weird when you do meet sort of wellness yogis in these places who, you know, claim to be very spiritual and in touch with themselves, yet they have no idea about the actual environment in which they're, you know, evolving. So, you know, I'd much rather see people not have a massage, not go to yoga, and instead connect with a local activist group about, around like conservation, or, you know, because that then makes, that connects you to a place, it connects you to other people, you're doing something that's positive. And I think the feelings that come from that, you get a better high from that than you do from maybe having a massage.
There's a moment when you go to a silent retreat in Victoria and you're quizzing your meditation teacher. He's talking about something about how you need to accept the status quo. But I think you can't stop saying to him, but what about injustice? We've got to resist injustice. How do you, how have you resolved that, or have you resolved that?
No, I absolutely haven't resolved it. It's a constant tension. I'm really interested at the moment in Stoicism, and I'm doing a lot of reading like Seneca and Marcus Aurelius, and Stoicism doesn't really have room for that either, for the activism angle. You know, it's all about what can I control, and if I can't control, if something isn't within my control, then I have to just let it go or not worry about it. And that's a very kind of rough, you know, summation of Stoicism. But, you know, they lived in really different times. There's a lot of bad stuff going on there, and, you know, they weren't having like marches, or, you know, women weren't powerful back then. So there was no real chance of rebellion or social change. Lots of wars. So Stoicism hasn't given me the answers. I don't know. I'm still looking.
You end the book by saying, we've had years of looking after ourselves. Now it's time to look after each other. What could motivate us to look after each other if wellness kind of becomes self-actualization?
I think everyone has their own kind of journey with that. So it could be having a child, or it could be being a carer, or it could be helping a friend through a hard time. Everyone in their own lives has a moment where they're like called to step up to the plate and put their own interests aside. That hopefully changes things for a lot of people. But the interesting thing about the moment we're currently living in, which is like sort of a time of environmental crisis, is that activists are asking us, all of us, to do it for the planet. So to really radically change behaviours, or, you know, agitate for structural reforms that will mean that, you know, we can stave off catastrophic climate change. So that's something that I think is looming.
Keeping in mind a column that you wrote, and after the coalition's win in 2019, you wondered if the federal election was our Brexit Trump moment, where one half of the country hates the other half's guts. I mean, you've already alluded to this deepening polarisation in the community. This call for everyone to look out for each other, how optimistic are you that can be achieved?
Well, I wrote that piece at Bill Shorten's party, and it was a sort of colour piece about the mood in the room. So it wasn't me saying, you know, half the country's terrible.
Well, you were worried. You were worried that this was This was a symptom of that.
And you know, there were people there who had misjudged the election and thought that people would vote for more kind of bigger policies that might, you know, help with housing issues or whatever. Now, with some time after the election, I think I'm not as pessimistic. I think that Australians still have a fair bit in common. We're certainly nowhere near, you know, the English or Americans in their kind of divisive social issues. I mean, I work at The Guardian, and we, you know, as a person who is there, we have really strong, you know, views on things like climbing Uluru and safe schools and gender diversity that aren't shared by other people. You know, there are kind of divisions, but ultimately I think we can all still sit in a room and get on.
Like we are right now.
Like we are right now. Yeah.
One final question. Have you found serenity? Have you found the peace that the world can't give?
I'm definitely, you know, I'm down the road. I'm walking down that road, and it's good. Like, I'm less reactive and a bit more chilled. And I think that's possibly just getting older and having been around a bit longer and seeing a few things. I mean, I don't drive, so that means I don't ever get angry in traffic. So that's a big thing about being serene. But yeah, no, I think all the work that's in the book, all the, you know, the exhausting courses and, you know, weeks and months of meditation, they do end up having some sort of impact, I hope.
This has been Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity with me, Simon Smart, and Justine Toe.
Check out Bridget's book, Wellmania, Misadventures in the Search for Wellness. We'll also link to those Guardian columns I mentioned.
Next week.
Live from the Dolby Theatre at Hollywood and Highland, it's the Oscars.
Today, Justin, we're going to talk about three stories, two films that came out recently and another from a couple of years ago, and all three deal with similar subject matter, and that is life within Nazi Germany, or Austria in one case, and people's response to this, and it seems to be a bit of the thing at the moment. There's lots of these films around.
You're growing up too fast. 10-year-olds shouldn't be celebrating war and talking politics.
Hitler.
If our leaders, if they're evil, what does one do?
You have a duty to the fatherland. The church tells you so.
You cannot say no to your race and your hope. You are a traitor.